Hello and welcome to the Brewman podcast. Today I am joined by SJ from Preston Baker. Thank you for being here, SJ, because you've got a really important topic to talk about, which we'll come on to in a little bit. But before that, please tell everybody a little bit about you.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to join the podcast, Nicola. Really privileged to be asked. I'm SJ. I work for Preston Baker, Yorkshire-based estate agency. Been around for the last 13 or so years. I joined them in the early days. Estate agency was never my ambition as a child. I don't think it's most people's ambitions.
No.
I think you fall into it accidentally. And I followed the sort of routine path, I guess. Now I did my GCSEs, I did my A-levels, I went off to university, I did a business and marketing degree, and I came home and had a couple of jobs that sort of filled time and was getting a bit restless, and my dad chucked the jobs paper at me and told me to do something about it, and I ended up being employed as a negotiator at Countrywide. And Ian Preston, who's the one of the principal partners at Preston Baker, gave me a job at Countrywide, and that was 16 years ago. And I've worked pretty much alongside him ever since. So I transferred with him when Preston Baker opened as a negotiator, and then have built on various roles in between, valuing, branch managing, area managing, until the role that I'm doing now, which is lettings and operations.
Cool. That's brilliant. No, yes, I think 90% of us fall into estate agency. I don't think anyone chooses it. But what you're here to talk about, actually, is... You want to talk about resilience and the hidden battles. So put a little bit of context to that, please, for our listeners.
Yeah, sure. So some people will know, some people won't know. I unfortunately, 7 or 8 years ago, had to take a leave of absence from work. I've always been fairly active, always been fairly committed to my work. And I play a lot of hockey, or I used to play a lot of hockey outside of work. And I gained an injury, which meant that I'd blown a disc in my back, which subsequently meant I lost the use of my right leg. So come the age of 30, there I was in York District Hospital on my back, staring at the ceiling, pressing the buzzer so that the nurse could help me go to the toilet and help me relieve myself, and wondering what the next steps looked like. And I learned to walk again at the age of 30.
Wow.
Having been told that I wouldn't walk and I wouldn't be able to drive, and I sort of thought, soldiers to you, I'm going to make this work, and worked hard to make sure that I got back on 2 feet rather than just 1 foot. But I kind of, in some ways, I put myself in that own predicament, in that I didn't admit early enough that I needed help. And that's where the sort of the hidden battles bit comes in, I think. I'd been playing hockey, and historically I'd played at a reasonable level, and I'd come back and gone into work and sort of scaled back the level that I was playing at. And I was starting to get these niggles, these aches, these pains and stiffness after playing. And I just put it down to the fact I was getting a bit older and my warm-up routine and my warm-down routine weren't as good, and I wasn't doing as much in between training sessions to work on my cardio, to work on my strength. And so I just kind of chalked it up to my own fault for becoming a bit lazy, really.
Mm-hmm.
On the pitch, and work needed my attention. We were battling hard at the time to improve the Selby branch that I was working at. So we'd opened that in 2009, and we'd managed to get it to number one in the marketplace, not just for listings, because I think listings are great, but you know, you can list anything, you've got to be able to sell it. And so we'd got it there for sales as well. But once you're at the top, you're a target, right? So you've got to work even harder to maintain that position, because everyone's got you then in their crosshairs. And so we were working really hard to try and maintain that position. And I didn't believe that I could take the time off, not because I'd been told I couldn't, because in my head, it needed me there 24/7 to be able to do that. And so I ignored all the warning signs. I ignored the pain. I ignored the twitches. I ignored the sciatica. I ignored the tingling in my toes, until the point I came back in from an appointment one day and collapsed in the office and was off for 4 months after that.
My gosh. Oh, my goodness. So, and I know, not firsthand, but secondhand, because my husband had to have a disc removed or part of a disc removed, I know how agonizing back pain is, having seen him limp around for months and months and months on end with horrendous back pain. You must have been really quite, I can't imagine how much pain you must have been in.
Yeah, I mean,
to that point
it was intense, and it I should have done something about it sooner. But I was so determined to continue to make a success of the business. And I didn't need to be that determined because I had a great team around me. But I convinced myself that that great team was so dependent on me. And it sounds really arrogant. I don't mean it to be arrogant. I got myself in this rut where I just believed I had to be there all the time. And I didn't want to put my hand up. I didn't want to admit that I needed some time off. And I remember going into the doctors with my mum the day after I'd collapsed. And I said to the doctor, when can I go back to work? She said, oh, you need at least a couple of weeks off. I was like, well, can't we start with 48 hours? And she was like, absolutely not. And after 48 hours, I was totally bedridden and didn't get out of bed for 2 months after that. So it was tricky. But the one thing that I learned as a result of that was that the support around me had always been there. I'd just been too scared to put my hand up.
What to say, actually, I'm in pain or I need to deal with this and taking any time off.
Because
you just felt, did you feel that you were letting people down if you'd
Absolutely.
Done that? Is that why?
Yeah, I felt I was letting the people I admired and I respected in the business. I felt I was letting them down. I felt that because I'd been almost a control freak about everything that happened within the branch, I felt that without me there, the guys would flounder because they wouldn't know what to do next. But they did know what to do next because they survived when I took a week's holiday or 2 weeks holiday.
Yeah,
and I used to take holiday, so you know if I needed to take a breather, why wouldn't they survive? You know, if I needed to take a couple of days off to sort myself out, why wouldn't they have survived? And I just convinced myself that they couldn't.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons I've learned actually is how important it is to look after ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody said to me that a little while ago that there's only one of you, and you need to look after you because if you don't, nobody else will.
Yeah,
and that boiled down to me not. I was working stupid amount of hours, not looking after myself, eating crap, drinking crap, not doing any exercise. And I started to look at the people that do really, really well in businesses. And I'm not talking about the people that brag about waking up at 4 a.m. and all these big routines that they do. That's not what I mean. But generally looking after ourselves and realizing you need to take time to look after you, I think is quite a big lesson to learn.
Definitely, and not just personally, professionally as well, because it was an awakening for me in terms of how I led the team after that. I think prior to that, I'd been quite a taskmaster. I think it's probably the polite way to describe how I was like to work with. Total asshole, I think, is the other. because everything had to be 100%, 100% of the time. And there was no let up from that. You know, we had goals, we had KPIs that we needed to hit. We had certain standards that internally we'd agreed on that we wanted to deliver. And if it wasn't to the standard, it just wasn't good enough. But it took me dropping out of the business to realize that actually 100% from 100%, 100% of the time, so 100% from 100% of the people, 100% of the time, just wasn't realistic. And particularly when you set really high expectations for yourself and for your team, if you have personal high expectations and you can get your team to deliver 80% of your 100%, they're definitely delivering their own 100%. If that makes sense. And it's not about accepting unacceptable performance. It's about realizing when your expectations are so much greater than what has previously been done in the market or what they've previously achieved. You have to learn to balance that. And it's that balance that makes a difference. And I came back with a totally different mindset about how I was going to manage people. And actually, as a result of that, I also joined a property academy, which made a significant difference as well. But suddenly I had all these other agents influencing, you know, my thought processes and great trainers and, you know, great leaders being able to influence how you think about things. And that, you know, you talk about working on yourself. That's not just about your physical and mental well-being. It's about your professional development. And I think, you know, we're often guilty of getting to a certain level and thinking I'm the finished article, so to speak, when you're not really. You need to carry on learning. You need to carry on developing because we've currently got a whole generation of workforce coming through that think totally differently to how we did at their age.
Yeah.
They don't look like that. And so you have to be nimble. You have to learn to to lead in different ways for different people. And that's about knowing when to flex for the different battles for different people. You know, so I talk about the resilience and coming back to work. I came back to work as soon as I possibly could. I had a phased return to work. Ian and James were superb, by the way. When I was off, they were fantastic, and just went to show that I should have raised my hand sooner. So more for me for not saying sooner. Unfortunately, a couple of years ago, my marriage broke down. One of those things, a sad occasion, but it went the way of the dodo. And the last thing that I needed was to be told to stay at home, take a few days. I needed to be in work. And they were great. They gave me even more work to do to keep me occupied, to keep me busy, to keep my mind flowing. Yet the time when I had my issues with my back, the last thing I needed was pressure to feel like I needed to get back into work. And they totally reined that in. They gave me the space and the time and the support that I needed to be able to get my physical health back on track.
Yeah, they sound, I mean, I only ever hear fantastic things about Preston Baker, I have to say, and I genuinely mean that. And I think that the sign of a really good manager is somebody who's able to adapt what they're doing, or adapt their approach and the way that they handle people depending on the situation. And by the sounds of it, that's exactly what happened with you. They were very aware of what your needs were and how best to manage you in that situation. One of the things I'm interested in is that when you changed your mindset from being 100% of the time to 180, did anything drop? Did service levels drop? Did the standards drop? Or what did that actually do?
No, we went forwards. because the churn of staff stopped. So we didn't have we had a core of a team, the tripod we used to refer to ourselves as. So it was myself, a chap called James Danbury, who's now one of our new business directors, a lady called Anne Booker, who's our admin manager for the business. At the time, Anne was the administrator for Selby, James was the senior negotiator, and I was the BM lister in the branch. But we always had these two extra seats at the table, which were for two additional negotiators, and it was basically a revolving door. And I don't wish to sound proud of that. I'm not. It was, it was a bad way to manage. And once I started to be a little bit more understanding, a little bit more accepting of the fact that nobody comes into work to do a bad job. They don't wake up in the morning and think, I'm going to do whatever I can today to screw up SJ's day. That's not what I think most of the time. Like, I think for 99% of people, okay, you'll always get the odd one that's out to get you. But most of the time, they don't wake up in the morning and think, that's what I'm going to do today. They come in because they genuinely want to work hard. They don't want to do the right thing. And so once you become a little bit more accepting and understanding of that as a concept, then suddenly you can get more out of people. And once you get stability in the team, you probably don't want to hear this as a recruiter, but once you get stability as a team, the results that you generate off the back of that are so much better, because everyone understands how each other works together. They understand what the client expectations are like, and you don't miss that call back to Mr. and Mrs. Smith because Bobby's now left at the revolving door and somebody didn't pick up on Bobby's notifications. You've got that consistent team delivering that consistent result, and clients return, and you get referral business and recommendation business. God, I'm preaching to the choir, right? But by being more understanding, by accepting those slight variations away from what it is that you've set out as this super high standard you want to get to, you can get a better result from the team. Sorry, I went down a rabbit warren to get there, but...
No, I completely agree with you. And I had a feeling you were going to say that things actually improved rather than you lost your market share and stopped being top performers and all the rest of it. Because it is, I was talking to one of my team the other day and I was saying that managing is probably the hardest job, I think. Mm-hmm. BD, easy. You know, if you're good at BD, then, you're good at BD. There is, and I think sales is all about rapport and building up relationships and all that stuff. But managing people is really, really hard, and it's a very difficult thing to do. And it doesn't matter how many books you read on it as well. You just have to live it. And I think one of the things that we sort of touched on before we came onto the call was about how you need to have different approaches to different, not just different situations, but also different people. Yeah. And it can be, you can't rule everyone and treat everybody the same. It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. It definitely doesn't. And as I think all new managers, myself included, you go into management thinking that everybody wants to be treated the way that you were treated because that got the best result out of you. Mm-hmm. And you fail to recognize the managers that you'd had previously that maybe adapted their techniques, but you weren't part of that adaptation. You only knew about the technique that was used on you. And yeah. So you replicate that technique. And there's also this sort of expectation that you have to behave like a manager. I'm a manager now. I need to behave like a manager.
Yeah.
Well, how do managers behave? I mean, they're people. They're just people yeah. at the end of the day that have to interact with other people. And management's also hard because you manage people and people are 50 shades of wonderful, crazy, weird individuals. And so it's always going to be weird and wonderful because you've got all these variations that are going to kick in off the back of it. And yeah. one minute you think you're absolutely there with an individual and you've got it all sorted, and then boom, in comes the curveball.
Yeah, that's so true. And I've learned an awful lot about I was a manager many years ago when I was an estate agent. I was a manager then, and I think I was a terrible manager looking back on it. I really do. And I think some of the things that I said or did or the way that I behaved, because I had the attitude of, I can't be friends with you anymore because I'm now your manager. I'm not going for beers because I'm your manager. I'm very much just going to sort of disassociate myself from everybody because I'm your manager. And I just think that I never had any proper training, and going in now running the team that I do, I've just approached it in a completely sort of human way rather mm-hmm. than it, trying to approach it in a, oh, I'm the big bad boss way. And it just doesn't work.
It doesn't. But I think that comes with not age, but experience, because yeah. I've worked for some really young managers and I've got really young managers that work with me who are great, but they're really experienced. So it's not about their age. It's about the experience they've put into that point, whether it be at work, whether it be outside of work. And I think there's also an argument about being comfortable in your own skin, because until you're totally comfortable in your own skin, it's really difficult to be comfortable around other people, I think.
That's very true. And I would also say that I think that a good manager is somebody who can really offer mutual respect. Mm. And part of that mutual respect, I think, as well, is a bit of self-respect too.
Yeah.
To know, that, like, and I agree with that. That's that being comfortable in your own skin and being able to be totally honest, totally transparent. But also, like you've kind of mentioned earlier with your situations, you had a manager who was also very sensitive to what was going on with you.
Mm.
And understanding what you needed at different points. And just going back to what sort of the early part of this podcast, when we're talking about hidden battles, I think as well, a good manager needs to have a relationship with their team where they can talk to them about anything and everything. And their team feels they can come and talk to them about different things. And it's okay to ask for help. You know, you need to create that environment. I'm not saying that you didn't have that with your bosses then.
Mm.
But I think by the sounds of it, you were putting so much pressure on yourself to deliver that even if your bosses were going, SJ, do you want to chat? SJ, are you okay? SJ, can you take some time out? You'd have been like, no, I'm fine. We must carry on. I'm on this mission. And wouldn't have listened anyway.
British upper lip. Like, we shall march on.
Exactly that.
I remember a moment. And I think I've told this story to a number of people before. I remember being down at the Sunday Times Awards, and there was a chap there called Phil Harris from Australia, from Harris Real Estate. And he did must have been a 30-minute talk, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, but he did a whole talk. And the one thing that I took away from it, and this really influenced my early style of management, was that your team don't care what's going on with you. All they want is leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And that to a degree is right, because if you've stubbed your toe before you came into work, or you've spilled orange juice on the floor, or you've scraped your car as you drove it into the car park, what they want from you the minute that you cross the threshold into the office or you click connect on the Zoom call, they want to see leadership. They want to be inspired to go out and be their best that day. They want to be able to look to you for the extra bits that they personally might be lacking, because they've also had something go wrong that day.
Yeah.
But I took that to the nth degree, and I assumed that it meant that my team didn't give a damn at all, no matter what was happening. And therefore, I also assumed that my leaders also just needed me to be that inspirational person that was leading my team and wasn't showing any cracks and, you know, was able to deal with everything. And that wasn't the case. And it took me being at possibly one of my lowest ebbs for me to realize that actually my team did really care about me and they were genuinely worried about me. And, you know, they would come and visit me in my morphine induced state whilst I dribbled and spoke to them from my bed, you know, and sat in my bedroom with me, you know, in the most intimate of environments in some ways. And you know, great friendships were born off the back of that. You know, James is one of my closest friends, as is Anne, and that, you know, other friendships that came off the back of what happened a couple of years ago, where I'm closer now to some of the people at work than I've been ever. And people do care, and you have to remember that, yes, they need inspiration, yes, they need leadership, but ultimately when your chips are down and you've got your hidden battles, you can put your head above the parapet and you can say, guys, I just need to talk about this.
Yeah. It's something that I'm really passionate about. And if anybody follows me on my social media, my LinkedIn, and even to a certain extent my Facebook, I quite happily will put my hand up and go, I've messed up this week, or actually I need a bit of help with this, or I just want to share something to tell you how much of a rubbish time I've been having, or whatever it may be. Because I think that I'm very keen, and this whole podcast is all about this, and it's about just normalizing stuff and normalizing talking about different things. And that's the whole reason the podcast was set up in the first place. But I do that with my social media, and I've had people say to me, Nick, you share too much negative stuff, or you share too much personal stuff, or, you know, you can't be showing weakness, you know, you need to be sort of showing you as a real sort of force of a business and force of a woman. I'm like, no, I just want to show everybody what's really going on. And the response to that is that more and more people, I put a post on last week to just give this some context, put a post on last week to say that I was feeling a bit down in the dumps because I was struggling to sleep, because I was basically just worrying about being a business owner. And I had a message on LinkedIn from a guy in particular who said, you know, he wasn't brave enough to put a post out there, but he had young kids. He was getting chest pains and been to the doctors. He was only 35. Wow. He was stressing and panicking and said to me, look, you know, I just wanted to let you know you're not alone. And actually he and I have been messaging since, and hopefully he's planned to speak to him on the phone just to sort of have a chat with him. Don't know him from Adam. He's an estate agent. Don't know him from Adam, but I feel like if I can help him by him coming to me and he and I sharing that actually we weren't okay, that's really powerful. Because if we can help other people by putting our hands up and going, do you know what? All of this is going on with me, and I just want to tell you, because if this is going on with you too, then you can talk about it.
Not to get on a soapbox here, but I think social media has got a lot to answer for, because there are so many people's lives that are portrayed as these wonderful, smiley, happy, perfect worlds that it puts so much pressure on other people to aspire to achieve that and to replicate that in their own lives. And it's just not true. You know, we're not all 100%, 100% of the time. You know, we are sometimes 70%, we are sometimes 80%. And I'm a big believer in positivity. I'm a big believer that when you hit a down spot in your life, there will always be things that you can be positive about, you know, and you can recognize things. And I don't know if you saw, but I put a post on 2 or 3 weeks ago. I had COVID, and I put a post on about the 10 things that I'd learned as a result of catching COVID. And the first couple were about, you know, you get really sweaty, you're really tired, you lose your sense of taste and smell. But then it was other things about recognizing, you know, my neighbour rang me to dance on FaceTime with me just to make me smile.
Oh, nice.
and, you know, family, friends and colleagues were wonderful. You know, work sent me a care package which was full of food and supplies that I might run out of during the 2 weeks I had to stay isolated at home. And, you know, just there's always things to be positive about. And yes, when you hit the downwards, you need to be open about them, you need to share them so that people understand that not everybody's perfect. And great that this guy's reached out to you, how fantastic is that, you know, as a result of it. But we can all find the positives to drive us forward as well, because we know we've achieved them previously. So they are there again in the future. But, you know, maybe I'm just weird.
No. I completely agree with you. I completely agree. And I think that it's really hard because, like you said earlier on, if you're a top performer, the pressure to sustain that is huge. It's really high. I remember, so my kids' school, someone said to me, one of the teachers said to me, oh, we've got our, what's it called? Ofsted grading. And they said to me, we don't actually want outstanding. We want good. Because if you hit outstanding, you have to maintain it. And if you suddenly drop to good, then you're slightly frowned upon. Whereas if you maintain it good, then it's all okay. And that's really resonated with me with so many different things in life. I'm like, actually, I totally get that. Because once you hit this pinnacle, this point, the only way you've got to go is down.
Yeah.
You can't go up from that. And to sustain that real high performance is really challenging. And I see it in agency where people burn themselves out just constantly trying to get themselves to this, to sustain a level that they've hit. And I think it's really difficult when you're working in high pressured sales sometimes to maintain what we're doing. I think it's unrealistic. And I think that going back to sort of what we're saying about help putting our hands up to go, actually, I'm not okay, but also realizing that you don't have to be 100%, 100% of the time and all of those things.
And it goes back to the point that you made as well about self-respect and being comfortable in your own skin. Once you know what it is that ticks your boxes, that lights the fire in your stomach, you can be really clear about what it is that you want to achieve and how you get there. And, you know, we've made no bones in the past about the fact that we wanted to be number one at what we were doing in our areas. And we've refocused that in terms of our business outcomes, in terms of providing exceptional experiences for clients. Well, if we provide exceptional experiences, then we will be number one because we'll generate great sales results or great lettings results. The client will have a wonderful time and that will build the market share. Instead of just focusing solely on market share, focus on the experience. And we sort of not made peace with it, but that's what our driving force is now. It's not just about world domination. It's about doing the job really well on the way to hopefully achieving that at some point. But ultimately, it's about making sure the client's happy on the way.
That's really good. I think that's spot on. And I think that's a very modern way of looking at agency, which is fantastic. Before you go, if somebody was to be looking at moving into a new management role, or perhaps was somebody younger in their career as a manager, so in the early stages of a management career, regardless of age, what would there be any advice that you would potentially give to somebody who was stepping into those roles?
Yeah. First of all, don't convince yourself you have to behave like a manager, because that specific mold, in my opinion, doesn't exist. We talked earlier about you managing people, and people are all different, and you're different, and you're in a new role, and so you need to continue to interact with people in a way which gets the best outcome. And there'll be some of your people where you've got to be really strict with them and give them really clear deadlines, really clear KPIs, and you have to ride them quite hard in order to achieve that. Yet there'll be other people you can wind up the clock toy and you can let it run and it will go off and get the result for you. And then there's other people that require a really soft approach. Don't ever forget that you're dealing with people, and all of those people are different and need a different outcome. Don't think that because you've got to that step in your career that you don't therefore need any support or training, because you do. You need it now more than you did when you joined, because you're dealing with people. So, you know, seek out training, seek out support. There's loads of free resources online. There's loads of podcasts. There's loads of TED Talks and things that you can listen to, you can watch. There's all sorts of resources. There's also some amazing training providers out there. I referred to Property Academy earlier, and you know, I'm a big supporter of theirs. I think they've changed the way I work significantly, and I'm really grateful to Peter and the team. But there's lots of support, so seek that support out, and don't ever think that you're bigger than the outcome. I think I thought I was bigger than the outcome that I was trying to achieve, and therefore I was too important to take any time off, and I was a fool for thinking that. And I can look back now and I could admit that, but I couldn't admit it at the time. And so ask for help, ask for support, put your head up, reach out, whether it be to a stranger through LinkedIn or whether it be to your leader or your colleague, reach out and speak to someone. There's agents together now that didn't exist when I was around, and maybe had it existed, that would have been a resource I could have leaned upon. But don't ever get yourself in a situation where you feel like you can't ask for help.
SJ, I think they are very wise words indeed. Thank you so much for coming onto the Brewman podcast and sharing all your experiences with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.